This interview was conducted by W.J. Hamm on November 28, 1973. The subject is Miss Joan Vanderford, an associate professor of English at Del Mar College, Corpus Christi, Texas. This interview was done in Miss Vanderford's office in the English building at Del Mar College. Miss Vanderford was born in Coleman County, Texas in 1913 and has been a teacher for 40 years. She relates her memories of early childhood, life on the farm in the 20s, and the Depression. She tells about the prejudices against her German parents during World War I, the differences in schools today compared to the 1930s, and describes her beginning career at Del Mar College, where she has been a teacher for 27 years.
I am Joan Vanderford. I was born in Coleman County, Texas, out in the country south of Coleman, about 18 miles, in a rural community called Shields. I was born December the 21st, 1913. I was the ninth child in the family and the last one. My oldest brother was 18 years old when I was born. I was the youngest of nine. Two children had died previously. My parents had seven living children, including me, when I was born. This was a rural community. We lived on a farm. My parents owned a half a section of land. We had what was called diversified farming. We raised cows and we had horses. We raised all our own horses. My father was very good at raising horses and handling horses. We had chickens. We had turkeys. We raised cotton. We raised quite a bit of wheat and oats, more than most of our neighbors did. We had more pasture land than most of our neighbors had. Water was scarce, so raising cattle and horses was something of a problem in order to have enough water for them. We had droughts, very bad droughts, and this was always a problem. We had cotton as one of our major crops, and wheat and oats, and we called it maize. It's now called something else, but we called it plain old ordinary maize. I went to school. It was a three-teacher school at Shields, Texas, and we had three grades in each room. We started what we called the primer. We went from the primer to the first grade, and the primer, first, second, and third were in one room, and then we had the fourth, fifth, and sixth, and seventh in another room, and then the principal of the school usually taught the 8th, 9th, and 10th. We did not have the senior year in this school, and students who wanted to graduate from high school had to go either to Santiana, Texas, or to Coleman, Texas, to finish school. We didn't even have buses in those days, so if a person in this community wanted to finish high school, he had to leave home and go either to Coleman or Santiana or someplace else and live away from home in order to have to finish his high school work. Practically none of my classmates finished high school when they finished school at Shields, Texas. That was the end of their schooling. When I finished high school, my parents did not choose to send me to Coleman or Santiana. Instead, they sent me away to school at San Marcos, Texas, where I finished in the demonstration school of the college there. I have some very vivid memories of my early childhood. I remember going to school with my brothers and sisters before I was really enrolled. I visited school a great deal, so that when I finally started school, I was quite familiar with school. Teachers didn't seem to mind, and I was always eager to learn. I really started school when I was 5 years old because my birthday came in December and my parents did not want to wait another year and there was no law against it. So I started school when I was five and found myself finishing high school at the age of 16 for that reason. When I started school, there was strong feeling against Germans. This was because of World War I. The war had ended just the year before I started school in 1919. The war had ended in 1918. And Germans were still not very popular in the community. My mother was German. My mother was born down in Austin County. Her parents came to this country from Germany. My grandfather, Meissner, was a doctor in Germany. He married a commoner, and his parents did not approve, so he and his bride came to this country before the Civil War. They landed at Galveston. They came here on the ship Solomon. My father was born in Mississippi, and at the age of four, he was an orphan. His father had died, who was a rather old man, and his mother was not able to support all the children, and she more or less gave my father and his twin brother away. They lived first in one home and then another. At the age of 13, my father and his twin brother decided they wanted to come to Texas. They'd heard so much about Texas. And they saved up the little wages that they could get working for people, their spending money, until they had enough money to pay their way across the ferry on the Mississippi. The rest of the way they walked and hitched rides and got here as best they could. And they came to Texas, and my father met my mother when they were 24. They were both the same age, and they were married. They lived in a German community until mother's fourth child was born, and she decided she wanted to move out of the German community, that she did not want her children to be brought up as Germans. She wanted them brought up as Americans, and she thought that they would not adjust as well if they stayed in the German community, and she insisted that they move out. So they moved to Coleman County about 1904. This was before I was born, of course. And later moved down to they first lived near Coleman, and then they moved to the community of Shields. I started school the year after the war was over, and there was a strong feeling against Germans. My mother was the only person of German descent in the whole community, and she was thought of as a yellow Dutchman, even though my eldest brother was fighting in France in the war for the American forces. Mother was not accepted in the community during the war.
What type of discriminations do you recall? Anything in particular?
Well, for instance, when the women would meet for the Red Cross meetings, they would not invite my mother. They would leave her out. They would not invite her to the quiltings or to the bandage wrapping, rolling parties. We had a rural telephone, and everybody knew because the operator would simply ring everybody's phone, and everybody would get on, and they would announce they were going to have a bandage wrapping or something for the servicemen, and they would all meet at a certain home. But they would always make it a point that mother was never invited. It wouldn't have anything to do with her. And then when we started school, my brother and sister, I went to school with a brother and sister who were older than I, we had to walk to school. We walked about a mile and a quarter. And we usually had to walk with a lot of other children. We went down the same road, you know. And there was anywhere from 9 to 12, 14 children walking together. And they would say mean things to us, like yellow Dutchman. And they would pull off our caps and throw them over the fence into the fields and say, run and get them, yellow Dutchman. Or they would take our books away from us and throw them out in the fields and tell us to run and get them, yellow Dutchman. They harassed us in a number of ways. My mother made what they called German sausage. The meat was stuffed into the intestines of the hog, where all the other children carried sausage. It was stuffed into domestic that had been sewed into tubes. And they insisted that this German sausage was filthy. And they made fun of our lunches, and they made fun of us in general. And we got to the point we didn't want to carry sausage to school, but we didn't want to tell our mother why we didn't want sausage in our lunch, because our playmates made fun of our sausage, and we would try to get her not to put the sausage in our lunch. She couldn't understand this. It was one of the better things to take in lunch to school, of course, and she made very excellent, very fine sausage. Of course, the irony of this is that 15, 20 years later, people all over the county would call my mother from all over the county long distance and want her recipe for sausage and for curing hams. But right at that time, when I started school in 1919, we were definitely harassed, and we were definitely not accepted there for a short period of time. And this was not because of any economic discrimination, because actually my father and mother owned more land than most people in the community owned. I mean, our farm was bigger than many of the farms. We had as nice house to live in as other people. We had as many conveniences and so on. When I started school, of course, we did not yet travel very much by automobile. We bought our first car in 1917, which was the year before I went to school, but we didn't use it as people use cars today. It stayed in the what we call the shed most of the time. But economically, we were as well off as our neighbors, and it was purely a discrimination because of the war and war feelings. Another thing I remember very vividly about the war that had a shocking effect on me, I was not in the habit of having bad dreams or getting frightened or getting scared. I was very, I felt very secure. I was not a child who felt insecure. All of us felt secure in the family. But one day my parents went into Coleman simply to buy produce or to shop or to buy the things we needed down on the farm. And they usually would take me with them because I was too small to do any chores at home, and I was not going to school at that time yet. So I remember going with my parents, and I think it was in the fall of the year, I'm not sure. But they were having some sort of rally in Coleman to sell war bonds. And the main street of Coleman is a very straight street, and it looked very long to me then. I think it's only about 3/4 of a mile long really now, but it looked longer than that then. We went in on the south end, and you can see we could see the courthouse for many, many blocks for half a mile before we got to it. And we could see there was a great gathering and crowd in front of the courthouse, which was at the very end of Main Street, right in the center of Main Street. And we got up to the place, we could see that out on the courthouse there was a casket or a coffin up on a framework, and around it they had piled hay, things that would burn, and they had a band there playing music, and there was a great rally, and they said they were burning the Kaiser, and they literally set the casket on fire and burned it. And of course, being a small gullible child, I really thought they were burning a body or maybe a man, and I had nightmares after this for 2 or 3 nights. It had a tremendous effect on me. And then this reminds me of another horrible custom we had out in this free teacher country school. Every time there was a death in the community, regardless whether it's a child or a man or a woman, everybody knew everybody else. School dismissed. The teachers went with the children, and everybody had to go to the church and attend the funeral. This was not very good either. I usually had nightmares for a while, or at least bad dreams after funeral.
Did this discrimination thing come up again in the Second World War?
Well, during the Second World War, I was not there. See, I was teaching school, and I was not living there in that community. My parents were still living there. But it did not come up in the Second World War at all. I had a nephew who was also in the Second World War. In fact, he was killed in the Second World War. But there was no discrimination whatsoever at that time. This had all disappeared. People had gotten much more broad-minded on this subject, and there was none of this in World War II. But my mother was very sensitive about it, and I could see that she got very quiet as World War II broke out, and this all started again because she had these memories from World War One, and at the time the Germans went into France in World War II, Mother was in the hospital undergoing surgery for cancer. She was 70 years old. And I was with her night and day because she was very old, and I promised her I would stay with her. And she was in semi-conscious there for about 24 to 48 hours. We had a special nurse with her, but I stayed with her every minute. I slept in the room with her. And the first morning after the surgery, the nurse was giving her a bath and trying to see how alert she was and trying to wake her up. And during the night, Mother had been talking in German, something that was very rare because I never heard my mother speak German except when some of the relatives would come to visit, and I had never heard her speak German until I was 9 years old. She would not speak it. And that night she was speaking in German while she was unconscious when she was so sick or in this semi-conscious state. Of course, they had her under sedation. And we had a little nurse with her who was of Czech background, I found out later. And so the next morning when she was bathing my mother and getting her ready for the day, she said to her, "Ms. Vanderford, what did I hear you saying last night?" And Mother didn't answer anything because she was highly sedated. And finally she said to her, "I thought I heard you talking in German last night." And Mother still didn't say anything. And then she finally said to Mother, "Are you German?" And that really woke Mother up. She looked her straight in the eye and said, "I'm as much of an American as you are." So Mother was definitely uptight when World War II came along from the bad memories of World War I, but it did not affect us at all or the younger members of my family in any way in World War II. Of course, I was already in Corpus Christi at that time, or about to come to Corpus Christi. That was the year I came to Corpus Christi in 40, and that was at the time Mother was sick in the hospital. So those are some of my memories of the difference in the two wars and the discrimination.
What do you remember about the cities back in the early 20s?
Well, I didn't see any cities in the early 20s other than the first city I saw that you'd call a city was San Antonio. When I went there in 1917 with my parents to tell my oldest brother goodbye before he was shipped out to France, and that was my first experience in the city. Up to that time, I knew nothing except small town life of Brownwood, Coleman, San Angelo, small towns that sort, Ballinger. And I don't remember too much about San Antonio except it was very, very big, and that I went to the zoo, and that there were balloons just floating around up over San Antonio because it's a military center, and they look like bedfellows to me floating around. I had never seen them before. But I didn't have any experience with city life really until I had gotten my BA degree, and I stayed pretty much in Texas. We didn't move around much, you know. The trip to San Antonio, I remember vividly, was most strange. We traveled at night. For what reason, I don't know. I don't remember. I remember my father went, and he took one of my brothers to help him drive, and my mother and I were in the back seat of the car with my brother's fiancé. The brother that was going overseas, fiancé, went along. And I slept off and on during the night in their laps. But I remember there were no highway markers, except there were yellow bands around the telephone poles and around the fence posts to let us know that we were on the highway. And there, once in a while, we would see a crude handmade sign telling us how many miles it was to some place. I know we started about sundown from home, and it took us all night long to get to San Antonio, which was only about 200 miles away. And we didn't even have any gravel road. It was dirt road all the way. It was one single path. There was no place for cars to pass. If you passed, you had to pull out the side and let the other car pass. There was no such thing as highways, not even any gravel roads then.
So you came to Corpus Christi in 1940. Where was your first teaching assignment?
My first teaching assignment was at Northside Junior High School, and it was almost a traumatic experience for me. I had come from a quiet, stable community in Bront, Texas, between Sweetwater and San Angelo. Nearly all my students were people who had been born and reared there. Their parents had been born and reared there. It was a ranching community. Great family pride. People had their roots down. There were no discipline problems in school in Bront, Texas. And a wonderful relationship between parents and teachers. Parents went out of their way to be nice to teachers and take us places and take us into San Angelo shopping, because very few teachers had cars. We didn't own cars then. I had my master's degree and was teaching in Del Mar College before I owned my first car. We didn't buy automobiles as young people do now. And I moved out of this very stable, warm community to Corpus Christi, where I had a very hard time finding a place to live because the war had started. We weren't actually in it, but we were getting ready to get in it. The naval base was being built, and we already had a number of Navy men out at the base. Corpus Christi was in a turmoil at that time. They were building the T-heads and the L-heads down here when I came here. I'd never seen this before. They were pumping mud up out of the bay and making the L-heads and the T-heads. The Driscoll Hotel was going up at this time. They were putting up the steel. And I had room 108 in Northside School, catty-cornered across from Driscoll. And the noise was almost deafening, and there were times during the day when the students could not hear me and I could not hear them. Because, of course, we had to have the windows up for air, and being in this warm climate, it didn't get cool weather for a long time. And my room was right over in the northeast corner where it picked up all this noise. In addition to that, right across the street was a filling station. And all day long, cars would drive in the station and drive out, and we had the noise from the filling station, too, the squeaking of brakes and the clang of tire tubes as tires were being changed. It was almost an impossible situation, teaching situation. In addition to that, I had about 50% of my students who were Mexican-American, and I had never taught Mexican-American children before. I did not understand their temperaments. I did not understand their culture. And I did not know how to motivate them. And sometimes I felt pretty helpless, though I had 7 years of teaching experience before I came here. I felt that those were the four hardest years of all my teaching experience. Also, I had been moved back from high school teaching to junior high school teaching. And I found that junior high school students were extremely difficult to teach in comparison to high school students that I had been teaching out at Bront, Texas. But I had a horrible adjustment, a tremendous adjustment to make, moving not only from a quiet, settled community, but to a city that was moving and bursting its seams, and under war conditions, and with a culture, having to teach students from a culture that I knew nothing about, plus all the noise. It was maddening. When I came to Corpus Christi, I had a very hard time finding a place to live. Certainly there were no apartments available for teachers in those days, or very, very few apartments. One would have to hunt and hunt a long time to find an apartment, and if he found one, he wouldn't have been able to pay for it, because my salary when I came to Corpus Christi was $1,200 a year, $100 per month, and we couldn't very well afford apartments. So we usually lived in rooms, or else several teachers got together and lived in apartments. And since I was a stranger here and didn't know anyone, I didn't have anybody to team up with and try to get into an apartment. So I started looking for a room, because that was really all I could afford. I was very fortunate. I got into a home with Miss Marie Kaiser, who lived on Air Street. She was a graduate nurse who nursed at Spahn Hospital all the time. She had a brand new home there. It had never been lived in before. In fact, I engaged the room before she had even moved in. It was a two-story house, and another teacher and I shared a room upstairs, and Miss Kaiser shared a bath with us, three of us using one bath, and we had two rooms upstairs. Her parents lived down below. She was taking care of her aged parents. The street out in front of the house was shell. Air Street was not paved at that time. A Spahn Hospital was very, very small. It was the old, old unit that we can't even see much of it anymore. It's been enclosed and surrounded for the rest of the hospital. There was only one shopping center in Corpus Christi, and that was Six Points. None of these other shopping centers that we know today were here. And Six Points was very simple. There was not a bank there, and the streets in Six Points were not paved, and there was practically no drainage. There was one red light there to keep automobiles from crashing where the six streets crossed. That was the only light. I had to walk up from the house that I lived on Air, which was right almost across from where the Church of Christ is now. I believe it's the 800 block. I had to walk up to Six Points for all my meals because, of course, we couldn't cook our meals at Miss Kaiser's house. So I usually had breakfast at Alameda Drug, and I usually had supper there. I got my lunch down at the New England cafeteria, which was close to Northside School, and our lunches usually at the New England cafeteria cost us 35 cents. They had a lunch every day. It was a very fine lunch, which would include apple pie, and a drink, and a dessert, and a vegetable, and a meat, and we got this, believe it or not, for somewhere around 35 cents. So actually the $1,200 salary wasn't too terribly bad, you see. Our food was pretty inexpensive. But going up Six Points for the evening meal and going up for breakfast every morning gave me a lot of exercise, and I did see some interesting things. Unfortunately, the first year I was here, it rained almost constantly. I was not used to this. And I usually had my feet wet because I couldn't keep my shoes dry and do all this walking. We could get a bus to school. We could walk up the corner of Santa Fe and get a bus. It would take us down to north side of school. And the buses came right by the house. If I wanted a bus to go to church, I could ride a bus to church. And the buses ran about every 12 minutes. This was most unusual. We really did have very good bus service then. And this was the main way we traveled in Corpus Christi. I remember one time we had one of these downpours, these floods that we can have here in Corpus Christi. And I went down Six Points late in the afternoon or evening to eat, and it was pouring down rain. There was a policeman who always stood on the corner there at Six Points and directed traffic. There had been a hardware store on the corner there. I don't remember the name of it now. It isn't there anymore. Finally, the storm caused the light to go out, the traffic light to go out, and he gave up. He couldn't direct the traffic. He just quit. The water was about a foot deep everywhere, and the manholes were being pushed off of the water, and two or three cars had run into these manholes, and their wheels had dropped down in them, and they were just stalled there. The other traffic was trying to go around them. And the policeman, he was a rather old man, just gave up and went home. Maybe it was the end of the day for him, or maybe he just gave up. Anyway, there was nobody there. And finally, some of the nice young men from the naval base came along. They got out of their cars, rolled up their white Navy breeches legs, and got out there and started directing traffic. And they really needed to, because at that time of the day, the ship that was going for the night shift was on the way to the naval base, and the ship that was coming home was coming back to the naval base. And Six Points was across roads of the world, and it was a really heavy, congested traffic center. Without the Navy fellows out there directing traffic, I don't know what would have happened. It was pouring down rain. They were smiling through the whole thing. Everybody was giving them cheers and went through and thanking them. It was a very fine relationship between the civilian population of Corpus Christi and the men at the naval base. They really supported each other and boosted each other. Of course, everybody did during World War II. We were all in there together, working for the same thing and supporting each other.
If you don't mind, I'd like to go back to an earlier period and ask you if you would describe a typical day, say, that your father had on the farm. What was a typical day in his life on the farm?
Well, it was pretty much for the whole family the same thing. We usually got up before sunup, and we usually had our breakfast before sunup. And before sunup, my father was out rounding up the horses that he would work for the day. He was feeding his horses. He was always very good to his animals, and so he wanted them to be fed before he took them out to the field. We didn't work with tractors. We used horses. And my father didn't have any mules. He worked horses. He didn't like mules. Those of us, the children, we were out before breakfast milking the cows. And my mother was up fixing breakfast while we were milking the cows, while my father was feeding the horses and seeing after the animals and feeding the hogs. My mother was fixing breakfast. We all had breakfast together. And if it was during the work season, then we immediately went to the fields. I started going to the fields with my brothers and sisters when I was 6 years old, and I stayed all day long. I didn't stay just a few hours, but we stayed from sunup to sundown. However, we didn't work as hard as some of the children in the community. Mother and Dad always allowed us a two-hour rest period at noon. They didn't want us out in the hot sun, so we would usually go in at 12 o'clock, whether we were chopping cotton or picking cotton or whether we were shocking maize. We didn't head maize. Some of the neighbors did, but we always shocked our maize. And my father wanted to rick it and wanted to fodder. We would go in and rest till 2 o'clock. It was an extremely hot day. Mother would keep us in till 3 o'clock. Then we would go back to the field. She would always have lunch for us, of course. We would go back to the fields and work until the sun went down. And of course, this was pretty late in the summertime because the sun didn't go down until close to 8 o'clock, so we had a long day. We came in out of the fields and we honeyed the eggs. We milked the cows again. We carried in wood for the stoves and did the chores. Many times, Mother would do some of these chores for us, so we wouldn't have many of them. Mostly all we had to do was milk the cows when we got in and out of the field. My father never did do much milking, and he didn't do much of the other chores. He had plenty to do to see after the animals and to do the farm work, do the heavy work, work on fences and repair buildings and barns and do the many things that had to be done. In the winter time, my father would shuck corn and get it ready to take to the mill. If it was a rainy day, he would sit in the barn all day long and shuck corn. He always had work to do. Or if it was raining, he would mend harness, or he would oil the harness. Some of the men in the community would go up to the little country store and spend the day of swapping yarns. My father never did this. He seemed to always be too busy. If he went up to the country store, it was to buy some nails or get something he needed, and he always came back immediately. He might ride a horse there, or he might walk, but he would soon be back, and he would be working again. He would read the paper, the evening paper, after the evening meal by lamplight. He took the Fort Worth paper. He read it every day. And we started reading it. In fact, I learned to read by reading the comics in the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, where I went to school. And before I could read the comics, my brothers and sisters read them to me. And after he read the evening paper, he went to bed and went to sleep. So did my mother. The dishes were washed and put away. And we all went to bed because we were tired. There was no TV. In the winter time, we stayed up after supper and did our homework. And we had a lot of homework because, remember, we were going to a three-teacher school, and each class had about 10 or 15 minutes allotted to it, and most of the work had to be done out of class. And we sat at the big dining table and did our homework at night. Mother would sit back over behind us near the stove. Only one room was heated. This was the big dining room where the dining table was. Bedrooms were not heated. She would sit there and mend socks and darn clothes and put on patches. And my father would read a while and go to bed, or sometimes he would be in a talkative mood and simply talk in a low voice to Mother, and if he got to talking too loud, she would shush him and tell him he was bothering the children. We were doing our homework.
You know, today's modern age, with all these modern conveniences in the kitchen and everything, seems that women have a pretty snap job of it. I'm sure your mother didn't. What do you recall of her washing the clothes and just doing the regular family work around the house?
Well, Mother made all the quilts. She cured all the hams. She canned vegetables. Of course, we helped her. We canned our beans. We canned tomatoes. We canned all sorts of things in the garden. She always had a marvelous garden. She found time to work in the gardens in the afternoon. She sewed all of our clothes, not the men's clothes, but shirts and things. But she even made my father's sleeping garments and my brother's sleeping garments. She made all of our dresses. She sewed a great deal. And she preserved foods. We used to go to Bangs and Brownwood and buy peaches and berries because they didn't grow where we lived. And we always canned an awful lot of fruit. So that we were self-sustaining except for coffee and sugar, you might say. And so this ran into a lot of work. All this sewing, all this cooking, all this canning. And then on top of that, the washing was always a big chore, but we helped, of course. There again, the girls helped with the washing. But Mother would never keep us out of school. I can remember some of my classmates would miss school once in a while because their mothers would keep them out of school to do the washing. And this was something my mother absolutely refused to do. School came first. Didn't make any difference what else happened. We went to school, and we were never kept out of school to do the ironing or to do the washing or to do anything. Dad always managed some way, too, that we got the crops in without keeping us out of school. Some of the neighbors would keep children out of school to finish up the picking. Well, we had to pick right up till school time, but then if there was any picking to be done after school started, Dad would hire that done. We were not kept out of school to work in the fields. And of course, school was let out early in the spring. We were usually out by the 1st of May. We had only a 7-month school so that we could start to work in the fields about the time the cotton needed to be chopped. And we didn't start school till late in, most of the cotton was gathered before we started school in the fall. But even Mother would go to the field and help us. She even helped us sometimes after she would get through with the lunch and get the dishes washed. She would sometimes come up to the field and work with us. I think it was mostly to build our morale so that we wouldn't feel put upon, to sort of cheer us up. Or it might have been because she got lonely, or it might have been because she wanted this companionship with her children, but she too worked in the fields. And back to the washing, of course, the washing had to be done on a rub board. Mother made all the soap herself. We made it from the lard that we got from the hogs that we killed in wintertime with lye in a big iron pot. We had to cut the wood to fire the pot, and this was one of my jobs, to keep the fire going, and somebody had to stand there and stir it so that it didn't burn with a big wooden paddle, and we would stir the soap, and I had help do that. The time I was in high school, we did have a little improvement in the iron. Instead of the old iron that you had to heat on the cook stove, we did have a gasoline iron, and with a tank on the back of it, made ironing a little easier. We didn't have electric iron, but we did have a gasoline iron. But even in 1940, when I came to Corpus Christi to teach, my mother still was cooking on the cook stove. We did buy a Coleman gasoline stove, but she was always scared of it. It was there in the kitchen. We had two of them. And during canning time, when I was at home, well, I would always start the gasoline stove. It was easier to work with and would get hotter. But Mother wouldn't use the gasoline stove on the stove unless I was there with her. She was a little bit afraid of it. And we did have a separator, of course. We separated our milk. We sold cream. This was always a big job to pour this 5 to 10 gallons of milk through a separator twice a day and separate the cream from milk, put it in the cans. And then the cream sometimes was picked up by a route man. This was later, but at first we had to carry it into Coleman once a week ourselves. And of course, we didn't have any refrigeration. Most people had ice boxes that they put ice in, but we certainly didn't have any electrical refrigerators. We didn't have any electric lights. We did study by Coleman lights that had these mantles on that gave a nice white light later on, not at first. They weren't in existence when I was a very small child. By the time I was high school, I had a reasonably good lamp to study by.
Do you have any memories of the Depression that stand out? I know a lot of people suffered from it. Did it affect your family very much?
Oh, very, very much, yes. So the Depression, I have a lot of memories about the Depression. And there's one other little thing here that I want to mention, and then I'll get to the Depression. This is about farming. Other than having to fight the droughts, we had to fight insects. Grasshoppers was one of our greatest disasters almost. Grasshoppers could almost wipe out our crops sometimes, and we didn't have all the poisons we have today to kill them with. We did have some poisons. We used arsenic mostly. My father would work late at night mixing this stuff with bran. They would doctor it with syrup and all sorts of things trying to make the grasshoppers eat it. And then it had to be strewn by hand. We didn't have anything to spread it with except by hand. You just had to go out and broadcast it up and down by hand. And we even took strings, twine, and fastened rags and newspapers to them, and then great long lengths of it, you know, something like 60 to 90 feet of string with newspapers or rags fastened to it every 3 feet or so. And then we would carry this down the rows of cotton to scare the grasshoppers out, just to drive them out of the field, you know, drive them out into the pastures. Of course, it had to be done every day to keep from them eating up the cotton. And then we would strew the poison mostly along the fence rows, because we couldn't go out and just strew it all over the whole cotton crop. So it was mostly around the fence rows where the grasshoppers would come in out of the pastures, hoping they would eat enough of it that we could kill them and not lose our crops. But this was one of the things we had to fight all the time, the grasshoppers. And then, of course, another great disaster was the horrible hail that we had in 1923. Came on the 30th day of June and killed all of our crops, beat them into the ground, even killed a lot of our chickens. It came about 1 o'clock on a Saturday, and the chickens didn't get in fast enough. Turkeys were drowned and beaten to death by it, and horses and cows had big bruises on their backs, and we didn't have any window glasses left in the house anywhere. All the beds were puddles of water. Shingles were beaten off the house. All the floors were standing in water. All the linoleum was ruined. And we didn't have any dry place to sleep. And there was no federal aid, no Red Cross aid. And there were no government loans. Everybody had to make it on his own as best he could. We made it by borrowing money from one of my brother's mother's brothers, who lived in East Texas and didn't have any children, was fairly well-to-do. Uncle Charlie financed us that year, and when the fall came, my older brother and sister, the others were married from home, but two just older than I, went to East Texas and picked cotton with relatives to make money to buy their school clothes. And even though I was only 9 years old, I went up to Santa Ana, Texas, and stayed with a cousin and picked cotton for 3 weeks. And when his crop was gathered, I left there and went to live with a married sister north of Coleman and picked cotton. And I made about $65, which paid for all my clothes. About the Depression, we began to feel the effects of the Depression in 1930. Which was the year that I went to San Marcos to finish high school. And Mother and Dad had very little money, and we knew it. But my brother and I went down there, and we lived in rooming houses, and I started college. And, or rather, finished high school there at the college. Because we had so little money, I clerked in JCPenney stores in the afternoon on Wednesdays when they would have their sale, and then every Saturday in order to pick up a little extra money. My brother was playing football, so he didn't do anything for a while. Later on, he got a job as usher in a theater. But the next year, I started to college at Texas Tech. And before I went to college, I stayed out the fall semester because I didn't have any money. And Mother and Dad didn't see how they could send me to college. My brother had not done so well in high school, and he still hadn't finished high school, even though he was older than I, but I had finished high school in San Marcos and was ready to go to college, and I had decided I wanted to go to Texas Tech. My mother didn't want me to go. She wanted me to wait until they could. She kept hoping that times would get better and that they could send me to school and I could stay in the dormitory and I could go to school like other people, you know. But I stayed out one semester and worked in Coleman as a telephone operator. I wasn't really old enough to work as an operator. My parents had to sign up for me because I was not of age. I was still only 16 years old. And I worked all that summer and that fall. And by that time, I had saved enough money that I thought I could pay for my books and pay for my fees. I think my fees were only $17 a semester. And I persuaded my father to drive me to Lubbock and let me investigate. We went to see the Dean of Women, and she got me a job. And I worked in a home as a maid for a family by the name of Jones in Lubbock. They had three children. I did all the laundry, and I did all the house cleaning, and I washed all the dishes for my meals and my room there. I did not have room myself. I had to share a room with one of the children. But I had to work too hard there. I became exhausted, and the Dean of Women finally moved me into another place where I could work from my room with a Chrysler family. And then I waited tables for my meals up at College Inn, which was the only dormitory. It was not on the campus. It was a private-owned dorm off the campus on what they call the drag. And I waited tables there and also cleaned the bathrooms, cleaned the toilets before breakfast, and cleaned the living room at lunch. And for a while, I also, that summer, I couldn't work at College Inn. They didn't have any students there. And also, I'd had a tonsil operation, was not able to hold two jobs, so I worked at a rooming house and waited tables. So I was definitely affected by the Depression. And then I was eligible to teach by August. I went to school in Texas Tech from January through August and got my teaching certificate. I'd already gotten one while I was in San Marcos. It was called a second grade certificate, but I had a teaching certificate, but I still wasn't 18 years old. So I told the only important lie, I guess, in my life, and went out and got a job and started teaching in September before I was really 18. In December. The last 3 months I was in Tech, I had to borrow money because I had had a bad time with my throat and my ears, and I'd had to give up one job and working only one job. One of my brothers, my oldest brother, the one that had been in the war in France, sent me $50 to help me out. And then I needed another 100 to get me through the school, so my brother-in-law went with me, and I went to a bank, and with his signing the note with me, I got $100 at 10% interest. There was no such things as student loans or government loans or scholarships. You did it on your own. And I borrowed $100 and finished the summer school, and that made me eligible to teach. And I taught my first school out at Groseville, Texas, which was close to shallow water, Texas. It was a big consolidated school about 9 miles out of Lubbock. And I was definitely affected by the Depression. We all were. And then the second year I taught school was the year the banks closed when I was teaching. And I remember that very vividly. My father came up to get me. I was teaching here at Coleman and told me the banks had closed and he couldn't get any of his money out of the bank at Coleman. None. And he had a little money. There'd been some rumors of this, and he had put a little money in a little bank over in a little town called Valero, Texas. It was a ranching community. and he wanted me to drive him to Valera. He didn't like to drive, to see if he heard that bank was still open and he needed some money. So he came up to get me, and I drove him to Valera, and sure enough, we found the bank there open, still operating, and Dad got enough money to buy the necessary supplies out on the farm till this bank business was over with, when the banks were closed. Another interesting thing about the Depression, I remember that one on Thanksgiving, I was teaching a little rural school out northwest of Coleman called Whitechapel. It was a little two-teacher school, and I was getting paid $85 a month for 8 months of teaching. And my father came up to get me and take me home for the Thanksgiving holidays. I had no car then either. And he had to go right through Coleman, and Mother sent him up to Coleman with some what we'd call bakers. They were bigger than fryers, some for chickens she wanted to sell. We would sell enough chicken, you see, enough cream to buy our sugar and our coffee. Other than that, we were pretty well self-sustaining, and our flour, and a few clothes along that we had to have. The Mother sent Dad with some of her chickens that day. I don't remember whether it was a dozen or what, but it must have been about a dozen of them in a crate. And we had a Chevrolet car that had a what we called a turtle on it, you know, the back. And he'd carried the crate up in this turtle, and he'd gone to the produce house and had sold Mother's chickens. Then he'd come on up to Whitechapel, which was on the other side of Coleman, and pick me up. And I could see he was pretty blue and pretty depressed. And when I got in the car and we started back, we had to go back through Coleman to get home. He pulled this bill of sale out of his pocket and showed me what they had paid him for Mama's chickens. And he was worried about having to go home and show my mother how little he'd gotten for them. They had paid him the big sum of 7 cents a pound for them, and they had cleared about 21 cents per chicken. This is what he'd gotten out of them. And when I saw the sales slip, I was angered, and I said to him, "They shan't have them." And he said, "What do you mean?" I said, "We're going back to the produce company, give them their money back, and get our chickens back." So we went back by the produce house, and Dad took them their bill of sale and gave them their money back, and the chickens were still there in the crate, and we carried our chickens home. Mother had a big pressure cooker, and I spent my Thanksgiving holidays cleaning, picking, dressing chickens, and we canned the whole business. We put them in cans. We cooked some of them as fried chicken, and some of them is baked chicken, and some of it I fixed this with chicken and rice, but we canned the chicken. I told Dad, I said, "They shan't have them for 21 cents a piece." And so again, we were sort of self-sustaining, you see. We made out. But I think the thing that, one of the things I remember most about the Depression, I think that hurt me most, was one time when I went home from college, and I was ill for a short period of time. And one summer, had to stay home. It was the fall of the year. I don't remember the exact details. I didn't miss a year of teaching. I guess school had started late. No, I remember now they had dismissed the semester for the fall picking out in at Lubbock at Groesville, where I taught. They would teach a month, and then they would turn out school because the cotton crop was gathered so late out there, and then they dismissed for 6 weeks, you know. And then start up again. And I had gone home during this time and found that my mother, to make ends meet, I didn't know she was doing this, was taking a cotton sack. Now, she was past 60. She was 62 years old at this time. She was taking a cotton sack. She was born in 1870, and this was in about 1932. Going down the rows where they had already cut the maize, and the binders always knocked some of it down on the ground. And she was picking up these scattered heads of maize. They were big, nice, heavy heads. And she couldn't stand to see them go to waste. And she was picking, going down these rows, every afternoon, after she would do her housework and get her dishes washed and get her laundry done. It was fall of the year, it wasn't too hot. She was going down those rows, picking up those heads of maize and saving them to feed her chickens and her turkeys, saving everything that could be saved in order to make ends meet, because we couldn't get money out of anything. You see, we couldn't buy anything. We had to be self-sustaining. And everything you could save was that much. And I found out she had been doing this sort of thing also while I was in college. In order to raise more turkeys and to raise more chickens in order to pay my college fees and help me have some clothes, and making every sacrifice possible even when she was 62 years old. Because, see, I was the last child. There was no child she could send out to the fields to do this. And my father was busy breaking the land and sowing the wheat and oats, hoping that it wouldn't be dry and hoping that we would have a crop. Of course, the Depression was doubly bad up there because we had a drought for about 3 years. The drought was at its peak, I believe, in 1934 is about the worst year of the drought. We had about 3 years there, a horrible drought, in addition to the Depression. So, yes, I do remember the Depression.
Do you recall any of the Roosevelt New Deal policies getting up to your part of the country and helping out people?
Yes. The PWA was very active, and the CC camps, the boys who went into CC camps, and a lot of our neighbors had to join the PWA in order to make money, to have money to live on, to buy groceries or to buy medicine or to buy the necessities of life. I had a brother who worked on what they call the PWA for a while. He was married and had three children and simply couldn't make ends meet. And he worked for a while. One of my brothers did for the PWA. They got paid $1 a day, and some people complained they were lazy and leaning on their shovels. The people who were complaining about this, of course, had never tried to go out and work on a road gang all day long. You can't use a shovel all day long, or a grubbing hoe, or a pick. You have to lean on it sometimes. The human body just isn't made to work a 12-hour day without a break with a shovel and a pick.
You say you've been teaching school since 1940. You came to Corpus Christi, and 7 years before that, so you've been a school teacher quite some time. What are the most noticeable differences between school when you first started back in the 30s and now?
Well, that's a rather general question. You mean in salary? You mean pupil-teacher relationship, parent-teacher relationship? You mean student study habits? You mean equipment we had to teach with? See, I think of all these things.
Mm-hmm.
Vast difference in all of them, you see. Really, parents stayed out of the school. They let the teachers run the school. There was very little what we call meddling. Teachers were hired to teach, and they made the decisions whether the child was to be promoted and what he was supposed to be doing. I remember so well when I was in second grade, one day my teacher, Miss Odira Gillen, sent my mother a note and told my mother that she was moving me to the second grade, or I believe from the second grade to the third grade. And she didn't ask Mother whether she wanted me moved or whether it was all right to move me. She simply wrote my mother a note and told her she was moving me out of second grade to the third grade, with very little explanation as to why, except my mother assumed that the teacher thought I ought to be doing third grade work instead of second grade work. And so I was moved. And there was no objection or quibbling about it from my parents. If a teacher paddled a child, there was no quibbling about that. I got two paddlings when I was in school. In fact, Miss Odira Gillen had a rule that if you missed more than two words in spelling, you got a spanking. That was that. It didn't make any difference whether you were the president's daughter or who, you know. You got the spanking. And I got my spankings for missing more than two words in spelling. This was just a flat rule in the classroom. Now, she was the most strict disciplinarian we had. We didn't have any other teachers who did this. And none of the teachers, of course, had degrees. Most of them had 1 year of college work, just as I had 1 year of college work when I started teaching. But the students were there to learn, and students took instruction. They weren't always questioning about whether the curriculum was right or whether the tests were right. Teachers were hired to teach and run the schools, and they ran the schools. Now, when I came to Corpus, I ran into my first experience in 40 with what they call the guidance program. This was the beginning of counseling, where we had the counselors. This was another hard adjustment. I had a hard time working with counselors. They were pretty much, as I felt, interfering with my teaching and meddling, and mostly that's about what it amounted to at that time. I don't know if it's improved too much since or not, but we didn't take kindly toward all this counsel. I did run into something when I came to Corpus that I had not had any experience with before, and that was having students in different levels of work. We call them sections, you know. We've been calling them all sorts of things. We call them sequences, and we call them, I think in San Angelo, Texas, they call them rails, where you sort out your students according to their ability. Grouping, you know, we called it grouping back in the 40s, and they were in the middle of the grouping program then. And this was a fine thing, and I do think it was a fine thing. I think teaching would have been a nightmare without it here in Corpus Christi with the mixture, the student body we had. Down in Northside, I think it would have just been almost impossible to teach without this grouping system. And thank goodness, about the time they decided to throw the grouping system out, about 4 years later, I moved out of the high school work and moved out here to Del Mar, and I let them have it, but I think I would have been miserable trying to teach in Corpus Christi without some sort of grouping. I think it's very important and very necessary. It's good for the student, it's good for the school as a whole, and it certainly makes life possible for the teacher. It makes her possible to plan her work. This idea of individual instruction is just fine, but it's a nice theory, but you can't have 15 different levels of teaching going on in the same classroom with one teacher.
When did you move to Del Mar?
I moved to Del Mar in 1946.
What was Del Mar like then? Was it? I'm sure it's changed.
Del Mar then was one building, and it was then three English teachers, and the library, and the science labs, and the president's office, and the vice president's office. Only we didn't have a vice president; we just had a dean. We didn't really have a president. We had a dean, and the president of the college was Mr. M.P. Baker, who was superintendent of the Corpus Christi schools. They were merged at that time. We had one parking lot, and it was shell. And the science classes, we were upstairs in what is now the Memorial Building. The English classes were wherever we could get them. We had one office, about as big as the one I'm sitting in here, for the three English teachers. And on the other side was another office of equal size with a wire partition between it that I had to use and share both with the foghorn and the staff to put out the annual. And I had to teach five classes and also sponsor the newspaper and also sponsor the annual, as well as teach five English classes. I shared this office with Mrs. Creighton and Mrs. Evans, and then the next year Mrs. Grace was added, and then four of us were using this office. So there were four of us working out of one office, and we all worked out of one building. The library was down in one room, and we had one parking lot, and when it rained, it got full of water, and we nicknamed it Harbin's Pond.